Rationally Speaking is a presentation of New York City Skeptics, dedicated to promoting critical thinking, skeptical inquiry, and science education. For more information, please visit us at nycskeptics.org.
Welcome to Rationally Speaking, the podcast where we explore the borderlands between reason and nonsense. I'm your host, Massimo Pigliucci, and with me, as always, is my co-host, Julia Galef. Julia, what are we going to talk about today?
Massimo, today I'm delighted to welcome our guest, Dr. Paul Offit, who is the chief of the Division of Infectious Diseases and the director of the Vaccine Education Center at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. Paul is the award-winning co-inventor of the rotavirus vaccine Rotatec, the author of over 140 medical articles, and as well as several popular books, including this year's title, Do You Believe in Magic? The Sense and Nonsense of Alternative Medicine. Paul, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So, Paul, do people believe in magic? Or too many people believe in magic? What's the deal?
Absolutely. I think we need to believe in magic. You know, we need to believe that there's something greater than ourselves. I think that in the world of medicine, we're attracted to the notion of somebody like Bones McCoy from Star Trek. You know, he would take that scanner and he would scan the person. He would look on that scanner and he would know what the diagnosis of that was. There was no uncertainty about it. He was sure of it. And I think we love that. We love the certainty. It's people like Mehmet Oz and Deepak Chopra and Andrew Weil, I think, provide that. It's that guru thing, you know, that ex cathedra thing. They are just being handed stuff as if from on high. They're absolutely certain about it. They tell you every aspect of your life and how you should live it. We love that.
But you don't think it's a good idea, right?
No, I mean, unfortunately, it leads to a lot of bad decision-making. There was an article actually by Michael Spector that talked about Mehmet Oz recently in The New Yorker, and he went into the guru thing, you know, that as Oz would approach the studio, people would just come up to him because they just wanted to be near him, to touch him, you know, to use the New Testament analogy, to touch the hem of his coat. And I think therein danger lies. While it's good to have faith in your clinician or your healer, if you will, you know, if you go over the line and you fail to at least critically appraise what they're telling you, you know, you're at risk.
Paul, when you've practiced as a doctor, have you found that cautioning people about the uncertainty around the diagnosis or around the, you know, prognosis actually helps them, or do they find that distressing? Do you notice any kind of pressure or incentive to project certainty where there maybe isn't?
You want to be as optimistic as possible. I mean, I'll give you an example. We see children with cystic fibrosis in our hospital, and you know, when we do that, when we have outpatient clinics for cystic fibrosis, we virtually never have the older children being seen at the same time as the younger children, because the old, I think, Chinese expression is, when the gods are really angry, they show you the future. And so we don't do that. We don't want them to see the future, in a sense. And so you do provide sort of the most positive impression that you can, so that you don't want to take away hope, even in when situations are grim. On the other hand, you want to be, you know, you want to prepare people for what they can expect over the next few days or weeks or months or years. So it's a balancing act to some extent, yes.
But do you find that the practitioners of so-called alternative medicine that you've written about, including in Do You Believe in Magic, do you find that they're more successful in sort of convincing the public that their way is the correct way because they're more certain, or for other reasons?
Yes. I mean, certainly, I guess the areas that I would pick are the areas in which medicine has largely not been able to provide an answer. So, for example, for children with autism, there is no clear cause or causes. There are no clear cures. You know, for certain cancers that are difficult to treat, like, you know, brainstem gliomas or glioblastoma multiforme, I mean, you know, it's pretty grim. Or pancreatic cancers, I mean, so-called adenocarcinomas, it's pretty grim. So I think that's often where you'll see, you know, the alternative practitioner thrive, and they step in and they use phrases like, you know, what your doctor doesn't want you to know, what your pharmaceutical company doesn't want you to know. And that's when I think people really get ripped off, because there are certainly charlatans out there who are perfectly willing to make a fortune off of people's misfortune.
So, but one of the things that I find interesting, however, in these cases is that on the one hand, there's this that guru effect that you were talking about. But on the other hand, there seems to be widespread distrust of sort of expertise, you know, medical expertise in this particular case. A guru is still an expert, or at least he pretends to be an expert. And so I find that sort of somewhat paradoxical that people seem to latch on even celebrities, for that matter, as gurus. I'm thinking, of course, of Jenny McCarthy and the case of vaccine denialism. And while at the same time, they distrust the actual experts. So what's going on there? Is it a combination of wanting certainty and also, however, distrusting authorities that are somehow officially sanctioned? I mean, what's the deal?
No, that's a good question. I guess the example that I would use would be somebody like Andrew Wakefield. I mean, so Andrew Wakefield, you know, was that British surgeon who in the late 1990s put forward the notion that the combination measles, mumps, rubella vaccine caused autism. The paper was terrible. It should have never been published. It was published in The Lancet. And it wasn't a study at all. It was really just a case series. But he was certain that this was true. And even though study after study after study have shown that his hypothesis was incorrect, he still is certain that it's true. And if you ask him the question, I know this is true because I know someone who asked him this question. If you ask Andrew Wakefield the question, is there any study that could be done that would show you that your hypothesis is wrong? He would say no. Now, no scientist would say that, obviously, but that's what he said. Wow. That's a true story. So, and yet there are still, you know, sort of hundreds of people who, when Andrew Wakefield shows up at these national meetings for autism, like Autism One, just, again, flock to be near him because they love his immutability. They love his certainty. I mean, I think part of what makes science so attractive, at least to me, is that it's mutable, that we're willing to, you know, take a scientific textbook and throw it over our shoulder as we get more and more information because, you know, as we gather more information, things change. And that, to me, is actually comforting because I think science is enormously self-correcting. But some people don't see it that way. They see, you know, when they see one study that says one thing and another study that says another thing, they say, you can't trust science. But that's exactly why you can trust science, because right. Ultimately truths do emerge over time. I mean, it may take years, but ultimately truths do emerge. You just have to be patient.
That reminds me of this thing that happened to me a number of years ago when I was living in Tennessee, in Knoxville, and I was active writing for the local paper about and lecturing about evolution and creationism. And one of the local preachers wrote these really vitriolic letter, not surprisingly, about me in the local paper. And one of the things, his main argument was, I just don't understand why people want to believe something that changes every day. I rather believe in something that has not changed for thousands of years. And I guess that captures exactly what you're saying, that kind of mental habit that, you know, I can't, he was unable to deal with the uncertainty, with the fact that, well, we think that X is true today, we may change tomorrow because, you know, the evidence comes in and we have to change our mind. And that kind of uncertainty is just, it doesn't work very well for some people.
Yeah, science waffles. It's a waffler. You can't trust a waffler.
That's right. It's a flip-flopper.
Flip-flopper. That was the other one.
Now, however, when we're talking about, let's say, alternative medicine, which is a category that I think, like you, I actually, a label that I sort of reject. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, there is no such thing as alternative medicine. There is either stuff that works or some stuff that doesn't work. But let's use the label as it's normally employed. And the question is, for me, is this. So there are some kinds of alternative medicine that clearly, at this point, I think, definitely don't work. You know, homeopathy is my favorite example. There are, of course, clearly sound examples of, you know, very good science. On the other hand, treatments that have come out over the last few years that are equally clearly do work. I'm thinking antiretroviral drugs, for instance. But then there is there, I mean, that's the question for you, is there a reasonable area in between? Are there things that may fall under alternative medicine that may still, in fact, have a shot in terms of becoming real medicine, in your opinion?
Well, I guess, again, I struggle with the term alternative because, you know, as you said, right. If an alternative medicine works, it's not an alternative, and it's medicine. And if an alternative medicine doesn't work, it's not an alternative. But When I first wrote this book, Do You Believe in Magic, the original title was Quacks, How They Hurt Us and Why We Let Them. I really saw no place for this. But as I read more and more, and certainly read a lot of the studies about, I guess what we would call placebo medicine, I became sort of convinced that there is a physiological basis to a number of aspects of the placebo response. I mean, there are studies, I think, that have pretty clearly show that one can learn to release their own endorphins. One can learn to upregulate and downregulate their own immune system. One can learn to release dopamine. Those studies are pretty clear to me. So I do think there's something to that. And I had to debate this guy on a local NPR show within the past week. And he studies sort of moderators of stress. Fair enough. I was in the hospital a few years ago, and a guy came around. He was a chaplain, and he comes in, and it was like 2 o'clock in the morning. He asked me, did I want him to pray for me? And I sort of felt bad about saying no, even though I didn't really want him to pray for me. But I said sure. I mean, pray for me. And while he was standing there, sort of praying for me, it was all very common, And I have to believe that there's a physiology to that that is of value. So I think there is a role for this. And I'll give you another example. Like, this will surprise you, actually, because it involves homeopathy. Mehmet Oz on his show once said, when my children get sick, my wife gives them homeopathic arnica. If they stay sick, she calls me. Now, in some ways, you could make an argument for that, because probably 80% of diseases that we see on an outpatient basis at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia are self-limited. They're going to go away on their own. Right. If you come into a doctor's office with, a self-limited illness, a viral, cold or a viral sore throat or viral bronchitis, you may well walk out with an antibiotic, which isn't going to help you and could potentially hurt you. You may walk out with a cough and cold preparation that contains active ingredients like pseudoephedrine, which certainly can be harmful to young children. So you can make an argument that homeopathic arnica is not such a bad idea, and that it avoids those things that are potentially harmful. And when they don't get better, now you know that it really is something serious. The problem with that, obviously, is that it promotes the notion that homeopathy is in any way making you better, which it isn't.
Right.
So, Paul, what do you think about the ethical question of doctors knowingly giving placebos to patients in hospitals, placebos of some kind, whether that's, pill form or an activity the patient is supposed to do that might help, when there's no evidence that it works aside from the placebo effect?
I think deception is okay at low risk, at low burden, and low cost. I think we do it all the time. If you come into our hospital, you will find doctors that have long white coats with red stenciling that look official. We have, big machines that make interesting noises. You come into that building with an expectation of therapy. You'll have a doctor who, when they give you a medicine, will say, I really think this is going to work for you. And there are studies done showing that it is therefore more likely to work for you.
For me by telling me about it?
Yes. Now you're in trouble.
Sorry, when you were a little boy.
I'm sorry. When I was a little boy, to give you a sense of how old I am, my pediatrician would make house calls. And I remember him well. He had this big black bag, and I loved it.
About the big black bag. I've only ever read about that.
No, he had the big black bag, and there was tubing and syringes and medicines, and I remember there was a little thing of pills. And I remember this. His name was Milton Markowitz. He eventually actually became the dean of Connecticut's medical school. He was a brilliant guy. But I said, what's this? And he said, those are sugar pills. And I said, sugar pills? Because I had sugar pills in my little doctor's kit. I'm thinking, great, I'm halfway there. And he said, this is, it's for people who feel the need to take something, even though they're going to get better anyway. So I think it's fine. I really do think it's fine, because I think we do it. And so better that than giving them the prescription or the notion that they should take a cough and cold remedy, which isn't going to make their cough and cold better and could potentially hurt them.
Well, that's interesting. Well, so let's go back to some of these practices that fall typically under sort of so-called alternative medicine. So two that come up often with discussions that I have with friends and even with people who have a pretty good degree of skepticism about alternative medicine in general. But there's a couple of areas that come up as, well, there's been enough evidence that may be working and all that. And so I'm going to ask you what do you think of the evidence in those two areas. And those two areas are chiropractic and acupuncture.
Right. So I guess I'll start with acupuncture first.
Sure.
It's Acupuncture is really interesting to me. I mean, I have a friend whose name is Eric. We'll call him Eric because that's actually his name. And, you know, he's a professor of law at Penn's law school. Smart guy. He, you know, he teaches torts. He's a full professor, brilliant guy. And he says, you know, when I was when I had back pain, low back pain, I tried non-steroidal anti-inflammatories. It didn't work. I tried, you know, COX-2 inhibitors like Celebrex. It didn't work. And when I did acupuncture, it worked. And it did. I mean, I don't think he's lying to me. I think that's right. So what's going on? What's happening? And I think there is something therapeutic in that interaction. I don't think it has, frankly, anything to do with putting needles under the skin. I mean, you know this better than me. You know, acupuncture is a product of second century BC China. Right. That was a culture that not only didn't believe in dissection, but they punished those who dissected by killing them, which I'm sure was a huge disincentive to learning about human anatomy. So, you know, so they believe there were 12 meridians in which you inserted these needles because there's 12 great rivers in China. They believe the body had composed of 365 parts because there are 365 days in the year. So if you believe that the human anatomy isn't based on rivers in China or days in the year, they were just making it up, right? There's nothing accurate about acupuncture. And there have been studies done showing it, for those who benefit, it doesn't really matter where you put the needles. And that those recent studies, as you know well by Edzard Ernst, that when he was at the University of Exeter in England, show that you can use retractable needles. Now, there's a little data, it's not great, but there's some data to suggest that if you give naloxone to these people, which is an endorphin blocker, that you can, in fact, block the effect, suggesting that some people are learning to release their own endorphins. And that may be true. And the question is, what is it about that interaction? Is it that you're lying down, that the guy's talking to you in a soft voice, that there's music in the background, that it's burning incense, it's just the touch of the needle. There's something in that interaction that I think probably is therapeutic for some. Now, I think for most, it may just simply be regression to the mean. You tend to go to a physician when you're in your most pain, and usually chronic pains wax and wane. So who knows? But right. I do think that there might be something to that.
Paul, do you know if they've looked at whether it makes a difference if you go in expecting it to work or not?
That I don't know, but that's a great point. I suspect most probably do go in expecting. But I have a friend of mine who tells me the following story, which is great. He said, I had low back pain. I went to see an acupuncturist. I got acupuncture, and my pain went away. A year later, it happened to me. I did the same thing, and the pain went away. A year later, I had the same pain. I didn't go to an acupuncturist, and it went away. So, you know, that's probably the usual right. story.
But the thing about, before we move to chiropractic, so the thing about acupuncture, of course, is from an exquisitely empirical perspective, it is actually very difficult to do seriously well-controlled studies, particularly double-blind studies. I mean, you mentioned retractable needles, but, you know, even that, it's only a partial thing because there's still some kind of contact, and clearly it's not double-blinded, I assume, because the doctor, the experimenter actually knows what's going on there, right?
Yes.
So it is very difficult to do control studies. But the idea is that, as you were mentioning earlier, once you start showing things like, well, as it turns out, the overall magnitude of the effect is not it's not different from a placebo. When you pick the places, the points at random, there doesn't seem to be any difference with when you pick them the way we are supposed to pick them, and so on and so forth. At some point, I guess, it's a question of inference to the best explanation. It's like, okay, we cannot do a completely perfect double-blind controlled experiment, but we've done enough variations on the same theme that it's reasonable to conclude that there is nothing other than some kind of, you know, placebo-induced physiological effect. Does that make sense?
Yes, and I frankly wish we had a different word other than placebo, because I think when people hear the word placebo, they see it as dismissive, that right. it's just all in my head, it's not real, I'm really experiencing the same pain, I'm just saying it's less. But I really do think some people may experience less pain, and understanding that is important. I do think that those who practice things like acupuncture or chiropractic do owe it to the medical profession to, if something does work, really try and figure out why it works, or what is it about that interaction that's working, because then you should put the patient in the least possible risky position, because if it has nothing to do with putting the needles under the skin, then don't put the needles under the skin, because they can break off and lodge in livers and hearts and lungs, as has happened, sure. and they can introduce diseases like, you know, HIV and hepatitis B and hepatitis C. So don't put them under the skin if you don't have to.
Right. So what about chiropractic?
Yeah, I really have little sympathy for chiropractors. I mean, obviously, it's based on this notion in the late 1800s by Daniel David Palmer that that all diseases were associated with misaligned spines, right? I mean, he has a guy come into his office, does Daniel Palmer. The guy can't hear. He then sees that, you know, there's a so-called misaligned spine, that what he called a subluxation. He put it back in place, and suddenly the man could hear. It was the crack heard around the world. The problem with that, obviously, is that the eighth cranial nerve doesn't travel through the neck. So this was just utter nonsense. And you know, it certainly can do harm. I mean, we know that there have been many vertebral artery tears that have caused deaths. That's not conscionable. And I think, you know, what's the value of chiropractic, if any? I mean, if there's any value, maybe it's that the chiropractors spend more time with their patient than an orthopedist is going to spend, who may only spend 5 minutes and you're walking out with a prescription. And maybe there's something to chiropractors as massage therapists, but I don't see it as anything better than that.
Paul, are there any areas in medicine or just health generally that you think most skeptics don't understand or are, you know, misled about?
I'm not sure I understand your question exactly.
Oh, I'm sorry. So it's a common topic of discussion, acupuncture and chiropractic to a slightly lesser extent and homeopathy to a much larger extent are common topics of discussion in the skeptic community. So you know, self-professed skeptics are pretty much on board with your message there. I was wondering if there's anything that you think skeptics are not on board with that they should be on board with, or things they are on board with that they shouldn't be on board with. In the area of medicine, like vitamins or?
I see what you're saying. Here's what I would say. I mean, I think that doctors don't, at least practicing physicians, don't really know much about alternative medicine, to be honest with you. I think they tend to be very open-minded and are willing to accept much of it. I mean, to be honest with you, I'm not sure this answers your question exactly. The reason I wrote this book actually was because of an interaction I had with my orthopedist. I mean, I had a microfracture surgery on my left knee during the recovery period, which was fairly lengthy. It was about a year. I saw my orthopedist, my University of Pennsylvania trained sports medicine orthopedist, who told me I should take chondroitin sulfate and glucosamine. It stunned me. I didn't understand why I should take that. He explained to me that this would help increase collagen deposition in my left knee, when in fact, and probably collagen is one of the most abundant substances made in the body every day. I'm well nourished. Wow. There's no reason taking that will increase deposition of collagen in my left knee. He also told me it had an anti-inflammatory effect and would therefore decrease my pain. There is no reason either chondroitin sulfate or glucosamine should cause anti-inflammatory effects. So I was surprised. I mean, but you know, you want your doctor to like you. I went to the GNC Center. I bought these things, which weren't particularly cheap. I took it for a day or two till I felt so ridiculous. I just stopped and looked it up and realized that this was something that had been studied, doesn't affect osteoarthritis. So it was just a silly question. But you know, why did he do that? I mean, why did he make that recommendation? There's a couple possibilities. The more sinister one is that it's a marketplace, that this is a $34 billion a year industry, and now there is no dividing line between the conventional therapist and the alternative therapist. They see it as a marketplace. They see themselves as waiters in a restaurant, and here's our menu. How would you like this? The more benign notion is that if he gives this to me, because it's going to be a placebo, it's not going to have any real effect, and it causes me to not take non-steroidal anti-inflammatories or not take COX-2 inhibitors, which do have side effects, then I appreciate any benefit, or it just gives me something to do because people like to take things when they have pain, then it's a value. I guess that's of some value. But it really did scare me, because for the first time I had the notion that there is no divide between the conventional therapist and the alternative therapist.
So one of the things that come up already a couple of times in this discussion is the money issue. So one of the things that I hear often from people who buy into alternative medicine is that they distrust big pharma because, you know, it's a multi-billion-dollar industry, et cetera, et cetera. But in fact, the alternative medicine industry also is a multi-billion-dollar industry, right? I mean, we're still talking about huge interests there, financially speaking.
Of course. This is big business. This is estimated to be by some, a $34 billion a year industry. The mega vitamin industry and dietary supplement industry is huge. Plus, big pharma is involved. I mean, Pfizer recently bought Alacer, which makes the Emergen-C line of products, so that's if not probably the biggest makers of mega vitamins in the United States. Huffman LaRoche has been in this business since the 1930s. I mean, this is big pharma. You know, I think I give credit to those who make vitamins and supplements at being able to convince people that they are, that these products are made by elves and old hippies on meadows. You know, this is, it's a mom and pop operation. We just care. We care because we want to give it to the people. This is the people's medicine. It's all natural. It can only help you. It can't hurt you. I mean, that is one amazing marketing effort, because this is big business. Like any big business, it sells things. And in this case, in an unregulated manner.
Speaking of unregulated, why is that? I have wondered for so long why food is regulated and normal medicine is regulated, but alternative medicine and vitamins are not.
In the early 1990s, David Kessler, when he was commissioner of the Food and Drug Administration, paired with Henry Waxman, Democrat from California, to regulate this industry. At that time, there were about 3,000 dietary supplements on the market. It was in the billion to $2 billion industry level, roughly. But they were media savvy, and they certainly had political connections. What he was worried about was that people were walking into health food stores and being given these supplements as therapy. This is going to treat your hypertension. This is going to lower your bad cholesterol. And that worried him. Fair enough. It should have worried him. And so he introduced legislation to regulate the industry. That was what he did. And the industry was so powerful that not only did they defeat that legislation, they introduced legislation of their own. In 1994, the Dietary Supplement Health and Education Act, called appropriately by the New York Times the Snake Oil Protection Act. I mean, this was an education act that had nothing to do with education, everything to do with the consumer not knowing what they were getting. And for that reason, this is an industry that's unregulated. I will tell you something, and this has just happened in the last couple of days. On July 29th of this year, the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia was probably the first hospital in this country to take dietary supplements off our formulary. You're not getting them from us anymore. And the reason is that at the very least, it violates our home medication policy. We don't let people give drugs that they bring in from home, like, say, amoxicillin, unless we can prove that it is what they claim it to be and that they've stored it correctly. By definition, dietary supplements cannot be proven to be what they're claimed to be. Label may well not reflect what's in that product. And so if you want to use a dietary supplement in our hospital, we strongly discourage its use. If you still want to use it, you have to sign a waiver form. This is the residents are not crazy about this, but this is what we're doing and have been doing since Monday.
But the food and drug industries are also very powerful. If they can't prevent themselves from being regulated, then how can the elves and hippies?
I think it's just history. This was, all drugs were an unregulated industry up until 1938. I mean, and that was because of the elixir sulfanilamide disaster, which was this sulfur product that was diluted in a large percentage of diethylene glycol, killed 100 people, including 34 children, and thus was born the 1938 Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act. So now drugs had to be shown to be safe before they were sold. And then it was the next disaster, the thalidomide disaster, that led to the 1961 Kefauver-Harris Amendment. So now drugs had to be shown to be effective when they were sold. But what happened here is it was a shadow industry. This dietary supplement industry got more and more powerful as they became more and more wealthy. And they have the political connections, not the least of whom is Orrin Hatch, who continues to defeat any attempt at legislation to regulate this industry.
That's amazing. So as usual, I guess what the moral of the story is that it takes for a few people to be killed, especially preferably children, I guess, and then something gets done. I mean, it's ridiculous, because it's the kind of thing that you would think that people would look at the evidence and would look at the actual situation and act proactively before there is a catastrophe like that. But I guess the history of this field shows exactly the opposite, as you pointed out.
Yeah, I think the Michael Harris, who's a historian, says, and this is right, the history of drug regulation in the United States is built on tombstones. But I'll tell you this, this is going to change. It is absolutely going to, I don't know if you just saw the most recent FDA recall. It was a recall of vitamin C. It was a recall of B-complex vitamins that were made by, I forget the name of the company, it was Healthy Something products. And because, what was it contaminated with? It was contaminated with steroids, including anabolic steroids. And so in other words, anabolic steroids were part of these vitamin supplements. This is the constant drumbeat. I don't know if you subscribe to the FDA Consumer Watch, but you know, but 2-3 times a month, they're doing these recalls of these heavily contaminated products. I just have to believe that the tide is going to turn, and we're going to be right where we were in 1938, eventually with these supplements, and we're going to regulate them because we have to.
Now, you mentioned mega vitamins a couple of times. Now, as opposed to, say, multivitamins that people take on a regular basis, is there an actual distinction there, or is all not particularly good for you?
No, I think multivitamins, which contain at or about the recommended daily allowance, don't hurt you. I think most people don't need them. I think people get much of the vitamins they need in their diet, although they don't think they do. So it makes for a lot of expensive urine. I mean, I'm talking about, you know, megavitamins. So by megavitamins, right. What I mean are those supplements that are 5 times, 10 times, 20 times the recommended daily allowance.
Right.
Sorry, briefly on the recommended daily allowance, or on your point that most of us get the vitamins we need, that's another thing I've been confused about for a while, because when I actually look at the foods that I eat typically during the day, and I think I probably eat more fruits and vegetables than the average American, there's no way I'm getting close to the recommended daily allowance of most of the vitamins and minerals. I don't understand how most people could actually meet those quotas.
Yeah, I mean, I guess what I would say is, how many people with scurvy and rickets do you know? I think, you know, most of us do get what we need. I don't understand. You know, I just think it's sort of all part of the toxic environmental hell thing that we're always convinced of, that foods are processed, it's not natural. You know, you can't possibly get everything you need. I think we do get what we need in our food, and I mean, there's enough data now, I think, to convince one that if you eat diets rich in fruits and vegetables, that is of value, because you're getting presumably more antioxidants, and that lessens your risk of cancer and lessens your risk of heart disease and potentially lengthens your life. So I think that's all good. But the megavitamin thing, what amazes me, and again, I give credit to the industry for this, that they can convince you that that's a natural thing to do is remarkable. I mean, I went into the GNC Center last week and I bought a vitamin E bottle because I had to do this talk in DC and I wanted to have props. So I bought vitamin E, and on the front of it said vitamin E natural 1000. If you looked on the back, it said that it was 3,333% of the recommended daily allowance. That's 33 times the recommended daily allowance. If you open up the bottle, it had a gel cap that was about half the size of an almond. Now, an almond is actually a rich source of vitamin E. But in order to get what was in that capsule, that one little capsule that was half the size of an almond, you would have to eat about 1,700 almonds, roughly.
That's perfectly natural, yeah.
Yeah, that's not a natural thing to do. And you know, people should be a little suspicious of that, because no one's going to eat 17 pounds of almonds because they would think that may be bad for them. But they'll ingest this, assuming it's good for them.
That is an amazing comparison. One of the things that often come up, and in fact we've discussed it right at the beginning of this episode, in the context of the popularity of alternative medicine and in fact the popularity of skepticism about standard medicine, is the role of celebrities. You know, we mentioned Jenny McCarthy, who's now getting a prime spot on ABC on The View. What's going on there? Because we talked about the gurus. You know, I understand somebody like Deepak Chopra, who pretends to have the answer to everything. Okay, he's popular because people like certainty. But what about people like McCarthy or similar, you know, other celebrities? Why would anybody in his right mind think that is a good idea? Oh, they didn't. She's a model, so naturally she knows about, you know, science.
Because people think they know her. They see her on the big screen or little screen. You know, she's spunky, she's funny, she's attractive, and they believe they know her. I mean, I when people buy products, they buy the person who's selling the product, much more so than the expertise of that person. I mean, my father was the head of a sales force for men's shirts for years, and I he would let me go to the sales meetings. And the point that he made to his salesmen, these were salesmen across the United States, was that when people buy shirts, they're buying you. They're not buying the shirt. I mean, a good sale, the line was, a good salesman can sell anything. And the point is, it doesn't matter what your expertise is. It, people are buying you. And I think that's true with Jenny McCarthy or Suzanne Summers or any of these celebrities who obviously have no particular expertise in medicine or science, but you're buying them. I mean, just watch television and look who advertises, you know, for various products. It's not, you know, Queen Latifah advertises for CoverGirl. It's not because she's a cosmetics expert. It's because we think we know her. Or yeah. Snooki advertises for pistachio peanuts because, right. You know, we yeah. think we know Snooki, you know, I guess.
The first time that I noticed something like that actually was when I was still living in Italy. And when I was young, I had the passion for astronomy and telescopes. And so I subscribed at some point to Sky and Telescope, which is a major, you know, American magazine. Unlike the Italian equivalent, Sky and Telescope at the time, and I'm sure still now, had these advertisements of, you know, very nice looking telescopes right next to very attractive young women. And I remember that my thought was, what is that about? You know, why do I care that there is an attractive young woman next to the telescope? I want to know about the technical characteristics of the telescope. You just didn't see at the time anything like that in an Italian magazine. And it struck me as, you know, a very different way of, you know, what exactly are these people selling? But this is essentially what's going on here. People are buying into personality because they're buying into the person. They think that they know the person.
Yeah, you remember those ads, though, don't you?
Yeah, that's right. Absolutely. Much more than the Italian equivalent.
One thing that's really struck me is just how much, even if you know that, you know, a single anecdote isn't good evidence, or, you know, an attractive person isn't more likely to be right about science, even if you know that, it can still be hard to override your sort of automatic intuitive, you know, the automatic heuristics that your brain is using that are subject to things like the, you know, the halo effect or the availability bias. I don't know if Jenny McCarthy actually intellectually believes that epidemiological studies are better evidence than anecdotes, but even if she did, I think she might find it hard to look at, you know, a single child like her son who develops autism shortly after being vaccinated and not feel like that's convincing evidence, because that's sort of how we're wired. So it's kind of an uphill battle.
Right. In fact, she's famous for saying exactly things along those lines that, you know, my son is my science. Exactly.
Yes.
That sort of thing. So that brings me to a related topic, which is the role of the media. In one of your books, in Autism's False Prophets, you correctly, I think, criticize harshly both Larry King and CNN for not doing their homework, and not doing fact-checking during an interview of McCarthy. She was saying things, and another guest on the show was saying things that went completely unchallenged and completely unchecked by the CNN staff, even though they were, in fact, demonstrably false. Again, what's going on there? I mean, it's either the media themselves seem to be buying into the celebrity culture, not just the public. And that's a little more difficult to swallow, because the media are supposed to be, you know, the journalists are supposed to be sort of the gatekeepers of what's going on here. But they're not doing, or at least some of them, are not doing their job.
Yeah, I'm not sure on what planet you think that journalists are supposed to be the gatekeepers of what's going on. I mean, I think the way that journalists do this thing is it's about being interesting. It's about ultimately selling advertising. And you know, they have this mantra of balance, which is I think, wrong, because often they'll tell two sides of a story when only one side is supported by the science. I think they're awful. And obviously, I, as a general rule, television is the worst. Obviously, local television is probably even worse than that. But, you know, I can tell you, this is a true story. When there was a show on ABC's 2020, this is when Hugh Downs and Barbara Walters were the co-hosts, and it was about, Sylvia Chase was the correspondent. They did a story claiming that the hepatitis B vaccine caused sudden infant death syndrome, caused chronic rheumatologic diseases, and caused multiple sclerosis. Now, at that time, there were actually two studies that had already been published showing that hepatitis B vaccine neither caused nor exacerbated multiple sclerosis in people who had it. So I emailed and called, you know, this was my early 1990s. I think I wrote to the correspondent, Sylvia Chase. I wrote to the person who was the executive producer, never heard back. But I ran into a junior executive producer for that show a few months later, and we got into it. And it got sort of, the conversation got louder and louder. I was getting frustrated, and so was she, until she finally said to me, and I quote, look, our job is to be interesting. If it also happens to be true, great.
Wow.
That's a quote from an executive producer. So that was really sort of a seminal moment for me. I think I realized that when people ask you a question on national television, they're not really interested in the answer. They're just interested in being interesting. And that's what makes this all so awful. The media doesn't see themselves as having responsibility to educate the public. Not at all. Their job is to be interesting to the public.
And it's kind of a race to the bottom, right? I mean, if I choose to be, you know, boring but committed to the truth, and my opponent in the marketplace chooses to be interesting and not so committed to the truth, then, you know, people like me lose out. And I'm sure that's like at the top of journalists and news networks' minds.
Well, it's certainly that seems to summarize the history of media, especially the 24-hour news channels of the last several years. Yes, there has been clearly a race to the bottom, unfortunately.
Paul, before we have to wrap up this segment, I'd love to hear your take on how the anti-vax fight is going right now. Are they gaining ground? Are they losing ground? What's the status?
They have clearly lost ground. I mean, if you look at the way this story was covered 10, 12 years ago, it was two sides of the argument. You would have people quoted like Andrew Wakefield, Barbara Lowe Fisher, J.B. Hanley, Lynn Redwood. I mean, all the people who refused to acknowledge the science that has shown them that their hypothesis that vaccines caused autism was dead wrong. They're gone. I mean, their voices are gone. And I think I'd like to think it's for the right reasons, but I'm not so sure. The right reason would be because study after study after study has shown that they're wrong. And so the hypothesis is clearly fruitless and dead end. But I think it may be in part because Andrew Wakefield was not only wrong, but he was fraudulent and wrong. And people don't like frauds. I think the media were burned by him. And you know, the anti-vaccine people attached themselves to his star and came crashing down with him.
Well, that was sort of a lucky break, I guess. It's too much to hope, I suppose, that future dangerous quackery will turn out to have been fraudulent as opposed to just, you know, made up.
Actually, I'm not so sure about that because...
Really?
I suspect, I don't have a hard data at the moment, but I suspect that there is actually a fairly decent correlation between quackery and fraudulence. And, you know, it may turn out more often than one might think that purveyors of quackery are not just wrong, they're also fraudulently wrong, at least some of them. And if enough of them turns out to be the case, then maybe there is hope. For the wrong reason, as you were saying, Paul, but maybe there is hope.
Yeah, maybe that should be more of our strategy going forward, focusing not on this is really poor scientific evidence, but instead on, like, look, this person was deceitful in this way.
Yeah.
We're just about running out of time now, so I'm going to wrap up this segment of the podcast and move on to the Rationally Speaking Picks.
Welcome back. Every episode, we pick a suggestion for our listeners that has tickled our rational fancy. This time, we ask our guest, Paul Offit, for his suggestion. Paul?
Yeah, I read a book that won the Pulitzer Prize a couple years ago called Emperor of All Maladies, A Biography of Cancer. It was by Siddhartha Mukherjee. It's a wonderful book. I mean, it's written by a guy who's a Rhodes Scholar, you know, Harvard graduate, researcher in cancer. And he is uniquely talented in his ability to be able to explain cancer therapy simply, starting from the 1920s and 30s when, you know, we were really lost, up until, you know, our ability now to define specific oncogenes, to define therapies like, you know, Gleevec or Herceptin that are directed against the products of those aberrant genes. And it's a wonderful book because it's great science and it's great storytelling by someone who clearly can write. And at the same time I read that book, there was a show by Piers Morgan on CNN where he had Suzanne Somers on the show explaining her book about cancer, which was called Breakthrough, you know, and the subtitle was something like Talking to Leading Cancer Experts. And her story, you know, was all just what you would expect. It's coffee enemas, it's miracle diets, it's celebrity endorsements and patient testimony. meals, nothing about oncogenes. And it's those two books, it's as if they were written in two parallel universes. And what bothered me the most in that was that here's this wonderful spokesperson for cancer. And on CNN, instead of seeing him, we see her. And you know, what did Suzanne Summers, what recommends her? That she was Chrissy on Three's Company? I mean, I don't think that's good enough.
I have nothing to disagree with in that statement. Paul, it's been a pleasure having you on the show, and I heartily second your recommendation of Emperor of All Maladies. We are all out of time, unfortunately. So
thanks very much, Paul.
Thanks, Massimo. Thanks, Julia. That was fun.
It was. This concludes another episode of Rationally Speaking. Join us next time for more explorations on the borderlands between reason and nonsense.
The Rationally Speaking podcast is presented by New York City Skeptics. For program notes, links, and to get involved in an online conversation about this and other episodes, please visit rationallyspeakingpodcast.org. This podcast is produced by Benny Pollack and recorded in the heart of Greenwich Village, New York. Our theme, Truth, by Todd Rundgren, is used by permission. Thank you for listening.